Welcome to this interview of Dr. Dallas Willard. My name is Neil Plantinga. I'm from Calvin Seminary across campus, and it's my delight to conduct the interview. Dallas, in your book entitled The Great Omission, you state that too many Christians are trying to be Christians without being disciples.
I think the great fact of contemporary religion, Catholic, Protestant, otherwise, in our country, and basically the Western world as we call it, is the acceptance of being a Christian without being a disciple. And the effects of that are pretty intense. Because if you haven't decided to be a disciple, you have not committed yourself to a course of learning and growing. It's almost like walking up to someone on the street and saying, "Now I'm going to teach you algebra," when they haven't agreed to it. If you get someone who has signed up for a course and maybe paid a fee, and you say, "Now I'm going to teach you algebra," well, they're on board. But if you approach a Christian and say, "I'm going to teach you how to bless those who curse you," well, that may not be what they had in mind. And so I think, Neil, this is a tremendously important thing to realize. You hear endless complaints about the quality of Christians, from Christians and non-Christians. In my sort of atmosphere, you often hear non-Christians beating Christians with their own stick for not being Christian enough. And actually, there's some justification for that. But our form of religion, as good as there are many things in it, there's great comfort in it, but it doesn't deal with the issue of discipleship. We have conceded the point that you can be a Christian without being a disciple. And I think every individual and every person who is leading, teaching, and so on needs to think that out and say, "Well, where do I stand on that? But to begin with, am I a disciple, and how would I know if I was a disciple if not?" And you see parachurch groups and others that sort of take on discipleship in a specific form. On the left, social action is often called discipleship. On the right, discipleship is often associated with preparing to win souls. And the Navigators group has taken that position for decades. They are changing some now. They have rethought it a bit. And so they are trying to move more in the direction of spiritual transformation as discipleship. But I think we need to... I challenge myself regularly with the question, what am I learning from Jesus now? Because to me, a disciple in any area is being with someone, learning to be like them in a certain respect. So a child in fourth grade learning arithmetic at a certain level is a disciple of the teacher. They are with the teacher, learning to be like the teacher in a certain respect. I think that this is the great desideratum of our time, is to restore discipleship to the core of Christianity, not something optional for those with special interest, but rather the very core of Christianity. And if I go on too long on this, shut me up.
But no, this is the main...
This is really so important. That digs into our soteriology, because the conservative church generally now has a soteriology that has no connection to discipleship. It is simply a matter of believing the right things about Jesus, and not just believing them, but of course professing them, and entering, it should be entering into a fellowship of believers, often in our kind of individualism, it doesn't include that. And that's a great loss, not only to the church, but to the community, which is the most important thing that should be happening in any community is what's going on in the churches. And that should be a preparation for life that is suitable to the dignity of the human soul under God. And that would take care of so many of the other things we spend time worrying about in our communities if we just had a core of people that were shining like that, you know, living like that. Everyone knew that. And they would be able to take part in it because it would bear a witness of light. So at the bottom is our theology of salvation. And if you have a theology of salvation of a certain kind, it doesn't lead to discipleship. And there, I think, is the responsibility now. We who preach and we who teach have to make sure that the gospel that is heard from us is one that leads people in a natural way to become disciples of Jesus.
I suppose one way to describe the kind of Christianity that consists largely of belief in atonement, belief in forgiveness of sins, and belief that I'll go to heaven when I die, I suppose that this is really a form of cheap grace in some ways.
Yes, it turns out to be cheap grace in a curious way. Actually, I think it's doesn't work out very well, but it looks like that. It looks like, and Bonhoeffer, of course, made that very important point in his book on the cost of discipleship. But it's one of those cases where it's a false economy. What do we say? Penny wise and pound foolish. Because you really pay a price for not being a disciple of Jesus.
A higher cost.
A much higher cost. Much higher cost. You lose the joy of living together with people in a community of effective love with a view to eternity where everything that is good in your life, you can count on it. It is preserved and it's in the hands of God. And you don't have to eat yourself up with negative emotions. It's a terrible price that people pay for not being disciples. And we really need to emphasize that side of it. Because so often, we think only in terms of the cost and not of the benefits. But when you count the cost, as Jesus says, you count the benefits as well. See, if I have a worn-out car that is constantly nickel and diming me and failing me, I want to count that when I look at the price. So I don't just think it's going to cost me whatever, $25,000, but I think of what is going to save me. And the emphasis on the cost of discipleship that often sounds negative is complemented in Jesus' teachings with his parables of the pearl of great price and the treasure in the field. And that also is a teaching on discipleship, but it's a teaching of joyous acceptance with a knowledge of the great bargain you're getting. So you're a pearl merchant, and you find this incredible pearl, and you scrape all your little pearls together and everything else you've got, and you go buy that pearl, and you don't say, oh, this is terrible. You say, this is a wonderful opportunity.
C.S. Lewis says that God thinks our desires are not too strong, but too weak.
That's a beautiful passage. You know, he talks about a kid playing in the mud in a slum and decides not to go to the beach.
Right. Can't imagine what it would be like.
That's right. And that's a great illustration of how we underestimate the value that God places on us and the nature that He's put in us. And so we wind up doing ridiculous things when you see the larger scene. I see, that's how we need to present the gospel to the world, in terms of the greatest opportunity any human being will ever have. And try to give them a sense of their dignity. I really try to stress that. A phrase I like to use is, you are an eternal, or a non-ceasing, eternal being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. Just think of that. I like also to say that God's intention for each of us is that we should grow to the point to where He can empower us to do what we want. And people normally take a little time to get over the pronoun there. But it's very instructive to think about it, because of course He wants us to do what He wants, but He wants us to want what He wants. And that's really, I think, what we're here for, is to prepare ourselves through a process of growth to be what God intended us to be. And now, to me, Neil, that's the gospel. That's the gospel. And when we say trust Jesus, that's what we mean. That's what we mean. You look at Jesus and the magnificence of Him and what He called to and how He dignified every person He touched. And you realize there's something really big going on here. And I'm a part of that. And so maybe I'd better listen up and see if I can't get in on some of the lessons. The discipleship, when it's understood in that way, you see, it becomes the great thing that Jesus intended it. And then where we're in a given field, whether it is the arts or preaching or teaching or medicine or the military, I say that to just shake us up a little bit, that's what we're called to do. It's to live this eternal life with a view to forever. I like that old song, on a clear day you can see what?
Forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
You know, that's gospel. That's great. On a clear day. And Jesus has come to clear us up on those matters.
So then, faith in Jesus Christ is far more than faith in His person. It's faith really in His program as well.
Yes, and Peter has a way of putting it. Ye who through Him believe in God. Mm-hmm. And that's really the idea. You know, Jesus is now doing something. He has a program. Mm-hmm. He invites us to be a part of that. That's beginning to pick up on really a different way of stating salvation. I like to say salvation is participating now in what Jesus is doing on earth. That's salvation.
Not just an event, but a life.
A life, that's right. In 2 Corinthians 5, you have these statements about why Jesus died. And it says, He died for us that we who live should no longer live unto ourselves, but unto Him who died for us. Now see, that's a fuller picture of what atonement means. If you have atonement and it doesn't relate to the spiritual life, it's simply not adequate. Atonement, at one-ment, we like to say, is a way of entering into life. Our life is picked up in the life of the kingdom of God as we put our confidence in Jesus and trust Him. So trusting Him is the whole story, but you know, you have to fill it out. Many people who trust His death don't trust Him. as their ordinary life would show. And I don't really try to force anything on that with reference to the afterlife, because I'm convinced that God will let anyone into heaven with him who he thinks can stand it. Not everyone can. Not everyone will.
It's an acquired taste.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And you know, if you don't acquire it here, it's unlikely to hit you suddenly after you're dead.
You said the other day, it struck me, that there are a lot of Christians who are serene in their confidence that they can live pretty much the way they want, and when they die, they will love heaven.
Yes. And I think that that's an unwarranted assumption. But it comes, again, from a picture of heaven as sort of a resort or something, you know, where you just go, and maybe like a cruise, you know, where they just feed you and take care of you and entertain you and all that sort of thing. I think that would be right up there with at least some versions of hell. Having been on a few cruises. We're made to be active. That's our nature. And to be creative. I'm often impressed with how children, as soon as they can do anything, they want to make something. And then they want to give it to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so revealing. And you go to the other end of life and you talk with people and they say, I would like to leave the world a better place. I'd like to leave the world a better place. That's, I think, the same picture at different points in life.
Yeah.
And it would be wonderful if we were enabled to carry that with us through all the intervening years, where we tend to become so obsessed with ourselves and our career and recognition and all of that. And of course, Jesus lifts the burden of that off of us. He says, you don't need that. You are recognized.
I suppose that if we are human beings who have been created with this dignitas, that then some of the sins that take mockery is really a form of iconoclasm, because we are icons of God.
Yes. Yes. That sometimes I think I provoke people with things I say, and one is that sanctification makes everything easier. That the sanctified person is not one who struggles more mightily, but one who has got in touch with the things that make life easy and good. Mm-hmm. So that, among other things, you come to see that sin is really slop. You know what slop is here in Michigan, don't you? And it loses its attractiveness. When I was a child, I enjoyed shooting streetlights out with a BB gun. It no longer has any attraction. Now, I can't say that everything has progressed as well as that one. But frankly, I mean, you know, you come to a place to where you're confronted with a situation where others would lie and expect lies. Why should I want to do that? Why should I want to do that? And it loses its attractiveness. And this goes back to the Lewis comment about the kid playing in the mud in the slum. I mean, people don't know what a joy righteousness is. They don't understand the goodness of rightness. And they keep thinking it's some kind of imposition to keep you from something that's really good.
Yeah.
It just isn't like that at all.
Well, it seems pretty clear that sin not only grieves God and injures others, but it's really a form of self-abuse as well. If you are promiscuous, for example, you lose the possibility of real intimacy. And
that's right. It is self-abuse in the sense that you don't allow yourself to rise to the fullness of your powers under God. And thus, abuse always does that. It breaks down your powers. And when we turn to these things as sources of consolation or attraction that are wrong, then it stunts our capacities. It's like a kid that cheats at mathematics. Whoopee, they got a grade.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they betrayed themselves. And now they don't have the abilities that they should have. And of course, that's unfortunately something that it's very difficult now in my academic context to get any kid to believe, any student to really think there's something wrong with cheating or plagiarism, because it's simply presented as a rule of the house.
It's efficient.
Yeah, that's right, it's efficient. And this is true also in faculty affairs, the people who steal data and publish stuff that's not their own and so on. It's very hard to get anyone to feel like, I am a bad person because I did this. It's more like, well, I got caught. I'll accept the penalty because I agreed to the condition. But it doesn't mean that there's anything particularly wrong with me. We have now become practically incapable of moral judgment, especially as it involves moral opprobrium. And that's because of the withering away of an understanding of the moral quality of life. And if it's not elsewhere, then you can't turn it on. It isn't like a faucet you can turn on when you come to plagiarism. And the administrators tend to do that. So we're kind of lost there to these higher dimensions of education. A lot of this hangs together. I mean, is education a dignified and holy thing or not? Mm-hmm. And if it isn't, then it turns into another version of the rat race. And that's about it.
Yeah. Well, in order to be a disciple, to be a student of Jesus, to do what Jesus taught, Paul has this teaching that we need to, our old self needs to die, and our new self needs to come to life. In fact, it seems like that's one of the huge dynamics of a Christian life, dying and rising with Jesus Christ.
Yes, we have to come to grips with the fact that we have an old self organized around securing ourselves and advancing ourselves. And that's the one that loses the little child's enthusiasm to do something good and to do it for others. And now we turn in on ourselves and we form a domain of which we are the head. And that is the one that Paul recognizes so clearly. And I think Paul is using language which he understood not only from God, but also from the education that he received in Tarsus. And these people were pretty sophisticated by this time. You know, they were not just people out of the farms or something. They were very sophisticated. And he understood the idea that a person has an organization of their thoughts and feelings, habits of body and soul. He understood that and realize that it is possible to take that system, because it is a system, and disown it, and by the grace of God take on a different system where things hang together and you not have a problem with integrity and with maturity and all the things that we bemoan in our culture, because you now have an individual who has adopted a godly system of what is good and right, and that system is powerfully working in their lives. There's some very touching language. I think Colossians 3, where he lists the things you're to put off: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy. And he says, lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds. And what he's referring to there is that lying is no longer useful when you put on the new person and his deeds. And then he moves right into the systematic discriminations of people against people, because you've put off the old man with his deeds, so you don't need to lie anymore. And you've put on the new man that is renewed in knowledge. I'll paraphrase it a bit, is you put on renewed in knowledge in terms of the knowledge God has, the way God sees things. Now you put on God's sight, and it moves right into some of the most difficult things in human life, which is tribalism, in which there is no Greek and no Jew. Now, these people he's writing to were Greeks. And there is a real problem with the Greeks and Jews. No Greeks, no Jews, no circumcision, no uncircumcision, no barbarian, no Scythian, no bond, no free, but Christ is all and in all. Man alive, what a shift. You walk out on the street and you see all these people, and you don't fall into those divisions anymore, because you now, your mind is taken on the character of God's mind. That's how he sees Greeks and Jews and all the rest of them. So it's a great thing to understand that when we come to deal with all our social issues that we have. And we have so many in this culture, because in the economy of God, the secular world has, in at least under the influence of its Christian past, has begun to try to deal seriously with the issues that hurt people in the way they divide people up. And of course, the gender issues, the race issues, and all of those are primary ways in which we learn to despise one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when we step into God's mind, then we see people differently. And that's one of the problems with how we approach it, because if you just sort of go to war for social justice, you'll just have a lot more mad people. And maybe some things will get fixed, but you learn after a while that justice never does justice to justice. It's only if you add love that you can do justice to justice. Justice alone won't do it. And of course, there's no love without justice, so you have to understand love right to get that right. That, I think, is what Paul is talking about. You put off this old system, and you avoid the anger that comes when you're forced to treat people in a way you don't really think about them. We're pretty penetrated with anger over these social issues, partly because we haven't really solved them. I don't think there is a solution to them outside of this mind that you take on when you put off the old and put on the new.
Seems that in Colossians 3, as is the case in the Sermon on the Mount, as you show in the Divine Conspiracy, that anger is one of the big issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you put on,
mm-hmm.
patience, forbearance, forgiveness, that's all
that's right.
to do with anger control one way or another.
Yeah, it really does. The old version of the passage there in Colossians, put on bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering. They all have to do with dealing with anger, because anger is so fundamental. That then pushes you back one level to desire, because anger really always originates in the frustration of desire and crossing of the will. That's where anger comes from. And surrender of the will to God, so that your kingdom, your way you want it to be, isn't really ultimate anymore. And that's one of the applications of the cross, is to lift the weight of having your way. And once you do that, then anger subsides and contempt becomes irrelevant, and you're able to move on to other kinds of issues. But Jesus takes up anger in the way he does, I think, there in Matthew 5, because he recognizes that that is basic to most of the evil that people do. And if you pull anger and contempt out, and then you go into the other things he discusses, you're in a position to really make a difference, like this whole issue of cultivated lusting. Anyone who looks upon a woman to lust after has already committed adultery in his heart. Well, you work that through, and you find out that a lot of that kind of behavior, especially when it gets into the pornographic and so on, is really the result of frustrated desire. And then that moves on to getting rid of a mate. And you pull anger out of that aspect of life, it transforms it almost wholly. Anger is not just fundamental to killing, but fundamental to divorce and abuse and all of these kinds of things.
You said that needing to have one's own way is a burden.
Yes.
Maybe even a kind of tyranny.
Having to have your way is first of all impossible. You can't. Two reasons. One is, there is no one way that you have in mind. And if you decide to have your way, it's going to be up something that's going to make having your way in other areas impossible. So there's an internal conflict of desire that James discusses in the opening of chapter 4 of his little book, where he says, where do wars and quarrels and fighting come from? You want your way. And he goes on and discusses that. And then secondly, you know, it's also other people want their way.
Right.
So that accounts for the painful form in which so many people exist. They want, they can't have it. Others want something else, and so there's conflict that arises. And the way out of that is God's way. You surrender your kingdom to God. And that's, the cross really stands for that. The cross is an incredibly powerful image of not my way. And when I take that to heart, then I no longer have the burden of having to have my way. And that's like Atlas laying his world down. You know, it's just, okay. Now, I still want God's way. And I can still work for what is right and what is good, but not because it's my way, because it's the right way. And I can do that in humility and persistence and creatively and all of that, leaving the outcome to God. And then when I do that, I don't have to carry the burden of making sure things come out right. I may be sad because what is right may not happen. Other people have a say, and that is God's arrangement for now. But at least I can still love them and be with them, and be open to them, and listen to them. even though I disagree with them, because it's not a personal issue, it's a God issue. I am not defeated. I've placed myself in God's hands. And that's the meaning, I believe, the deep redemptive meaning of the cross that relates it to resurrection life. There are many ways of thinking about the death of Jesus, but one reason for his death is that we had to have a resurrection, and if you're going to have a resurrection, you need a death. And it would be good to have a very public one that no one could have any doubts about. And so we have the cross, but the cross comes to us in his resurrected life. It's Paul's statement to the Corinthians, "I was determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." See, that was his way of saying, I wasn't going to make anything happen. I was there and I talked, and Paul, I believe, chose purposively not to try to sweep people away. You know, the rap on Paul in 2 Corinthians 10:10 is, as he quotes it, and you have to wonder at him, I'm sure he learned to enjoy this, but as he quotes it, he says, "The rap on me, dear Corinthians, is that my letters are really heavy. But personally, I don't amount to much, and my speech is contemptible." Now, can you imagine a traveling minister with that in the way of a reputation? I mean, that's on his vita. His letters are heavy, but he's not much to look at, and his speech stinks. But, see, he was counting entirely on Christ. And that's why we have the results of his work with us yet today.
A nice part of your writing has to do with how we acquire the Christ kind of life, how the kingdom kind of life can actually be acquired. It's kind of striking to me that so many of the virtues of a new life, or even the big turning, repentance, are presented to us both as God's gift and also as our calling. And there's a mystery there, but they're clearly, we do have an end here that we've got to pick up.
Yes, that comes with the idea that we are actually supposed to put off the old person and put on the new. There's no doubt that this will not be done for us. It will not happen to us one day in church or somewhere else. It will come in the way you put on French or expertise at the flute or any of these other wonderful things. And there's really almost nothing in human life that you can have without discipline.
And taking pains.
Taking pains, that's right. Discipline, especially in the early stages, is usually kind of painful. But as the book of Hebrews says, afterwards, I love this phrase, afterwards it beareth the peaceable fruits of righteousness. I think that is so wonderful that they had that idea and saw it very clearly, that you go into training. Now, disciplines are a general feature of human life, of course, but they have a special role in growing spiritually. And their role is primarily to make us accessible to God's activity in us. What comes out of a spiritual discipline is not something that you could achieve on your own. It is something that will not happen unless you do something. But it comes as a grace. And so we speak of the gifts of the Spirit, for example. But if we don't do something, then those gifts won't be there. They come as grace. They leave no room for boasting. And our dependence on them, on these disciplines that result in the fruit of the Spirit, It's something we have to pick up intelligently. It's good if we have some teaching. See, one of the things that happened, unfortunately, in our past is that the increasing emphasis upon just faith led to a loss of these practice of disciplines that characterized not very far back, not very far back. If you go back, for example, in Scotland and read about how they practiced the Eucharist, where it was a three-day affair of preparation, the moment of community coming together for the Eucharist, and then a sort of after celebration, you can see what a tremendous difference that would make in people's lives. And so often for us, the Eucharist is just something we do because we're supposed to do it every so often, and it's over. But we miss the power of it as a discipline when we do that. If you engage the Eucharist in a way that has certainly been practiced in the past, and we can relive now, many consequences come about from that that you can't get on your own. And that's the general idea of a discipline, of course, is something that's in your power that you can do that has an outcome that's beyond your power. Simply can't do it. And that's where the Christian virtues all fall. Mm-hmm. You can't just be patient by trying, or even, as we jokingly say, by praying for troubles, on the principles that tribulation works patience. Actually, tribulation doesn't always work patience. It works bitterness also.
Yeah.
And it's only if you are surrendered to tribulation as a discipline, if you can accept it as such, that it begins to have that kind of an effect. But other disciplines, of course, are not imposed in the way that tribulation is concerned. You choose them. If you enter into solitude and silence, you prepare to have the patterns that lock you into daily life broken up, and to be freed up from the demands that other people make and the demands you make on yourself. And you're just there. And solitude is a very radical discipline because it pulls you out of all of the patterns that you're used to. You have to enter it wisely, and with some instruction will certainly help to keep you from expecting things that aren't going to happen and from trying things. As solitude is primarily is where you quit trying. Solitude is doing nothing.
You say in the spirit of the disciplines that we fear solitude and silence, mm-hmm. because we fear the embarrassment of discovering that there's not much going on between us and God.
Yes. And also I think that is a part of finding that we fear we don't amount to much. And so we plunge into busyness and occupation with people as a way of distracting ourselves from these fears. And when you go into solitude, and it takes a while, as I like to say, after you stop jerking, you will begin to have a different kind of experience, and it will be, in part, a discovery of your soul. You'll discover you have one, that there is a great depth and richness to you, and then God will be present with that. You can't convince people of that by talking at them. You have to present it to them, let them understand it, and let them experiment with it. But it is silence. I do a 2-week retreat for Fuller every summer, a great privilege, usually with mid-course ministers in their MDiv program. And we always have 24 hours of silence. And with almost no exception, that is the greatest thing they find. in that experience. Well, maybe. I always tell them when they come in, now you have to get 10 hours of sleep for the first 3 nights. This is almost funny to watch them because they show up after a while and they're actually rested. And they woke up because they had had enough sleep. But seriously, the hour of community silence is one of the things that most lifts them up into a different way of living with Christ, because they experience the reality of God with them in that. You know, talking is such a job. And we when we talk, we normally are kind of managing our world with our talk. And to stop, it means you lay that task down, and in solitude you begin to find a reality that you don't need to take care of.
We get Samuel backwards a lot. We say, "Listen, Lord, for your servant is speaking."
That is great. Yes, that is so true. And if we're going to break out of that, we just have to learn how to be silent in our souls. Solitude and silence are conditions that you learn to take with you wherever you are after a while. And you're not run by whatever's coming by and noise and talk and so on. The other thing about solitude is it cures you of loneliness. It's a strange thing to say, but it teaches you that you are something in yourself that God treasures and loves, and that God is always with you. It teaches you that, and you get accustomed to it. It also cures you of busyness. It takes the burden of validating yourself by working hard off of you. So these are matters of forming habits, spiritual habits. And once they're formed, then they stabilize you so that what we would call the temptations that come to you in life are much more manageable, because you now have a place where you recognize what is happening and you can deal with it. If you don't have a place where you recognize what is happening, then temptation comes down on you like a rock hitting you, and you don't have time to recognize even what you're doing. So it establishes a kind of inner space, an inner space where you are with God and you are not trying to do the impossible, you're not trying to validate yourself, and you can then very simply pay attention to other people, receive God where you are, and that's the richness of life that a disciple comes to with not a whole lot of practice. It doesn't take long. When you begin to experience it, it really grows. And then other disciplines make sense. You can experience many things as disciplines. There's no complete list of them. And some people need some better than others. It works out to a plan of life, of constant walking with Christ and seeing the kingdom of God at work around you. I love Paul's statement in 2 Corinthians 4, you remember, where he talks about while the outer man is decaying, the inner person is being renewed day by day, while we look not at the things seen, but of the things that are unseen. That's what you do as you become increasingly practiced in these parts of discipleship that we call disciplines, is you become aware of the unseen and of it working and acting and being with you. And you really realize you're a part of that. That's the world that is the home of the soul, as the old hymn says. That's the home of the soul. It'll take the body with it into that, but it is the natural place for people to live. I don't hesitate to say that it really is largely what the pre-fall life of the human being was. Communion with God of that sort. And of course it's even better now after redemption.
We can have a few questions or comments by any of us.
That's a wonderful and very important question, because if you try to do this individually, it will be much harder. You'll have less success. They are meant to be communal. And in particular, they're meant to be under pastoral direction. I don't necessarily mean the official pastor, but there's a type of direction that is pastoral. And it might just be a friend who is wise in these ways. But you need to practice them in congregations. Now, our difficulty now is that most of our congregations really don't know anything about them. And they will have a list of things that could be disciplines, but they're ordinarily presented as duties, like the tremendous disciplinary effect of prayer, for example, rarely understood. Gets a little emphasis in people who don't believe prayer actually makes any difference, that it's just kind of happy hour treatment. But we don't understand the full disciplinary effects of it. Now, we need to teach that. See, and the teaching function of the church, the pastors, the teachers, the times you use for instruction, they have to teach about discipline. That would begin with things like, are we really going to do the things that Jesus said? And if we have a yes to that, then the next question is how? If we have a no to that, well then, that's the end of that story. Go back to life as usual. But if there's a yes, and that takes some teaching itself, then you say, well now how do we do this? How would you learn to love your enemies? And the answer would be, we're going to have a program to teach those who would like to do that how to do it. That's where the congregation would come in, see, to say, you do this. I encourage pastors to use the disciplines as ways of pastoring. If they have the vision of personal growth in their people. See, then you say, here's method. And you have to work past the idea that method is opposed to grace. They have all these little barriers in there, but you can get past them. And then you can begin to teach people, for example, how to study their Bible as a discipline and not just something to get ready for something else. Or a duty. A lot of people read their Bible like they take medicine, a little pill every day, and that's good for you. But no, the Bible is a transforming book when you begin to understand how it relates to spiritual growth. And that's how you have to do it, I think. You have to begin with teaching and then lead gradually into practice for those who are ready to go. Now, many people in our churches won't be ready to go for a while. And they will say, in effect, I didn't sign up for this. And so you have to be patient and loving with them and give them time to change. But that's doable. And my experience with this is that it makes a tremendous difference in people's lives once they begin to get it. But to do it individually is an alternative that may be necessary, but it's not the best way. I'm sorry. Did you get the question?
Would you repeat the question?
Well, that question.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's actually an interesting and good title, because the church does matter in spiritual formation. And we mustn't, just the fact that perhaps currently, often there's no explicit connection, doesn't change the fact that if spiritual formation is going to happen, it's usually going to happen in a church context of some sort. That book is probably directed. Right now, you know, spiritual formation is just kind of everything, everywhere. And it's probably responding to an individualistic approach to spiritual formation. So that was spiritual formation as if the church mattered. Jim Wilhoit. Yeah. Actually, I think I wrote a blurb for that book. Thank you for reminding me of it. That's a pretty good book.
My question is,
well, if I understand the point, you need to be, I would say, very humble and cautious about what you have attained in the process of spiritual growth. You never get to the point to where you've sort of got it made. There are turns of life and the soul that you never suspect until they happen to you. Just an illustration. A very dear man, well known in evangelical circles, was telling me some time back, he had retired from seminary, he and his wife teaching, not this one, but another one. And he was talking about how he was having to spend so much time counseling seminary professors who had retired and fallen into depression. Now, you know, they never expected that. But as you age, different things come to the fore. And so we need to understand that there's a lot we haven't seen yet. Now, on the other hand, you do want to expect that you will make progress. That perhaps is the harder part for us today, is to think that you can really make progress. See, like many people who, for example, have had no experience of loving people who dislike them, or they might come to think that they cannot do that. But it depends on their teaching and their experience whether or not they can. The language of the 23rd Psalm, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies." That's a wonderful thing. And so descriptive of life. And so I think we need to both have high hopes and a sense of real dependency. I think that Calvin was extremely good on both of those, in my opinion. And I think he was a great spiritual master. He gets a lot of bad raps on one source or another, but I feel about him the way I do about Paul. These are people that were so massive in their influence on the world by their lives and their teaching that, you know, it's kind of childlike to pick at them. I think he was a great man, and I think he can balance both of those. And of course, when you read the third part of the Institutes, you see the depth of his idea of the Christian life, greatness of it.
One more.
Yes, sir.
There's a word that jumped out yesterday, and I forget exactly what it was, but you used the word easy.
Easy.
And just talk about that as, you know, we are running a race and we are struggling not against flesh and blood, but there's a sense of
that's right.
ease of discipleship.
That's right. I like to speak of learning easy routine obedience. And sanctification makes your path easier, not harder. because you gain new assurance, new direction, new orientation as you go along. And the things that might have upset you and tried you at one point simply no longer upset you and try you. And that's how it becomes easy. You don't carry the burden. For example, the burden of getting human approval. And you just let that go. And you learn you don't need it. And that's, it's learning that we don't need a lot of stuff that we thought we needed, I think, more than anything else that makes it easier as we go along. But we just don't need a lot of things that the world said we needed. And that brings the sufficiency of Christ, the sufficiency of God, home to us.
Well, that will be the end of our session. I want to thank you, Dallas, for your wonderful teaching and your wonderful manner with us. You have blessed us by your presence, and we wish, in turn, God's blessing for you.
It's a great privilege to be here.